What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Wednesday, June 4th, and game one of the NBA Finals is tomorrow. So we are going to talk all things finals. We've got the Pacers and the Thunder representing the East and West respectively this season. So going to give a quick summary about how these teams got here. Then we'll go into what I view as the six swing factors of these finals, where if one of these teams wins the majority of these things, then I think they are likely to win the series or at least have a really good chance to. After that, I'll talk through what is on the line for both of these teams. What would it mean if they won? What would it mean if they lost? And then lastly, of course, I will be giving my formal prediction and my reasoning behind why I'm picking one. But with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So I'm going to start out with how these teams got here, because they took pretty different paths to make it to the NBA Finals, and they had wildly different expectations coming into this year as well. So on the Pacers side of things, obviously this was a little bit of a surprise for them to be here at this point, but I really think their ascension to this point goes back to 2021, and they were in no man's land. If you look at their most used starting five that season, it was Malcolm Brogdon, Caris LeVert, Justin Holiday, Domantas Sabonis, and of course, Miles Turner. But that team went 34-38. They missed the playoffs. They didn't have a clear direction. They were kind of stuck in the middle in mediocrity, and it was unclear how they were going to get back to contending without sort of bottoming out. So after that season, they fired their head coach. They end up hiring Rick Carlisle, who had previously been with the team in the mid-2000s. Those were some very good Pacers teams that, you know, could have had a decent chance to contend if not for the malice in the palace really threw that team off, because those suspensions were basically year-long. So there was basically a year and a half where they were just not going to be able to contend, even though they had a group that was probably good enough to compete at least in the discussion about teams that could make it out of a, at the time, kind of weak Eastern Conference. But they bring back Carlisle. That next year, they're even worse, 25-57. I think they knew it was going to be a transition year. I think Carlisle knew what he signed up for when he joined the Pacers. But this was a very, very important year for the Indiana Pacers, because this is the season that mid-year they trade Domantas Sabonis for Tyrese Haliburton. And that is a trade that has changed this franchise forever and is the number one reason why they're here right now. At the time, the discourse around the trade was that it was a bit of a win-win, and the short-term returns for the Kings looked like they might have even won the deal. You know, the Kings go on to be the three seed the next year. Sabonis looks like an all-NBA level player, but history is not going to have this one age well for the Kings. But after they get Haliburton going into 2023, they actually start that year 23-18. They're the five seed in early January. They're exceeding any expectations that anybody had on them. However, Haliburton has a pretty significant injury. They go 2-16 without him, completely fall out of the playoffs. Just shows how valuable he is. But they were way ahead of schedule that year anyway. Then going into 2024, they really burst onto the scene. They get off to a hot start. They end up being the runner-up in the NBA Cup Final, which was a really fun event for them to just be able to, you know, get some more mainstream media coverage. And Haliburton was playing out of his mind at that time. And they were showing enough to the front office to have them decide to make a pretty all-in win-now deal in trading for Pascal Siakam around the trade deadline. So that was a huge deal for them. And obviously, we've seen how good Siakam has been for them throughout this playoff run as well. They end up winning 47 games. They avoid the play-in altogether as the sixth seed, make a surprise run to the Eastern Conference Finals. But the narrative around them was still skeptical, to say the least. A lot of people called their run to the Eastern Conference Finals fraudulent. Giannis was injured during their first round series. And then in the second round, the Knicks are just extremely depleted across the board, can barely even throw out a six-man rotation by the end of that series, and then they get swept by Boston in the conference finals. So a lot of people thought that was sort of fluky. But then 2025 25 comes around. They get off to a little bit of a bumpy start, 10 and 15 to start the year. Halliburton looks like a shell of what he did at his peak early in 2024. And there are some questions about who he is as a player, what this team is. Are they even a close to contending? But they turn it on after that slow start, and they end up finishing the season, including the postseason, 52-21 in their last 73 games. That's nearly a full season sample of them playing at close to 60-win pace. They kill the Bucks in the first round. They kill the Cavs in the second round. They make relatively light work of the Knicks in the conference finals. And here they are, showing that last year, the conference finals was not a fluke. I know that they took some help, but they learned from that, got even better this year, and are in the NBA finals. So you don't accidentally make the finals. You don't accidentally make the conference finals 2 years in a row. So Indiana deserves every bit of being here. They're a worthy conference representative in the Eastern Conference. They looked like the best team throughout all of the postseason, and here they are in the finals. On the Thunder side of things, I'm going to take this back to 2020, which is the first year of the post-Russell Westbrook era, which was really thought to be a transition, a rebuild year, but they trade for Chris Paul. They end up being too good. You know, they're the five seed. Chris Paul has an all-NBA level season, had a lot more in the tank than people thought, but they sell high on him after that season. They decide to sort of bottom out. They hire Mark Daigneault as the coach to replace Billy Donovan, a first-time head coach in his 30s. Very much a question mark, but clearly the right hire in retrospect. 2021 is nothing more than a rebuilding year, 22 wins that year. Same for 2022 with only 24 wins. Then you get to 2023, and they already are back up to 40 wins and in the play-in. So they did not have a very long stretch of being bottom feeders in order to get back to the top in their rebuild. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they drafted really well during that span. Over those couple of years, they took Giddey sixth overall in 2021, Chet second overall in 2022, Jalen Williams 12th overall in 2022 as well, and then Kayson Wallace 10th overall in 2023. So they've completely rebuilt their core. Shea Gildas-Alexander throughout this whole time continues to get better and better and better from what was almost looked at early as sort of a good stats, bad team guy into an all-star, into an all-NBA level player, and now suddenly an MVP, not only candidate, but winner. Then in 2024, they vault all the way from 40 wins up to 57 wins. They get the one seed in the Western Conference. They are just way ahead of schedule considering the age of where some of their core guys are. But going into the playoffs, there were still some real question marks about them. A lot of people worried about their size. They worried about their experience, myself included. I was very skeptical on them going into the postseason, despite their talent, despite their record, because they just hadn't even been to the postseason yet, let alone like taken their losses once they got there. And so once they got to the playoffs, they were bounced in the second round by Dallas and Luka in a series that, though it went six games, didn't feel like the Thunder were really that close to ever winning it. And in that postseason, they couldn't rebound the ball consistently. They couldn't compete with some of the bigger teams like Dallas with Gafford and Lively down low. And Josh Giddey just killed them, got benched, and his playing time dwindled because he couldn't shoot the ball consistently from outside. And he couldn't be successful in an off-ball role in the postseason. So going into the offseason, they had some very clear holes to address on this roster, and they did exactly that. They signed Isaiah Hartenstein from the New York Knicks on a semi-reasonable deal and fortify their front court with a reliable big man next to Chet to give them some optionality, some versatility, some size down low, some more girth down there. They also then trade Josh Giddey for Alex Caruso. You can debate over who the better player is, the more valuable long-term piece. But for what this team needed right now, there's no debating that Alex Caruso was just a better fit for this team, considering he's a much more consistent shooter. He's a more willing off-ball player and just playing within his role on the offensive end. And he is just an absolutely devastating defender, and he has shown out in this postseason so far. But then they come into this year with the revamped roster, with a year of experience under their belt in the postseason. They win a franchise record 68 games, the fifth best record in the history of the NBA. They have the second best net rating of all time in the league. They are now 80-18 on the entire season combined. Just been a completely start to finish dominant run for them to the NBA Finals. They've cruised through the playoffs as well. Obviously did go seven against Denver, but that series really was never in crazy question because they were never trailing in the series after they went down 2-1. And in game seven, that was a blowout pretty much from the start. So there was never any real tension of, oh my God, Oklahoma City might be eliminated right now, even though it did go seven games. And other than that, they have made light work of the Western Conference. And as a result, they are the seventh biggest favorite in the NBA Finals ever. So that's how those teams got here. There is another hilarious storyline of Paul George, who previously was on both of these teams, and the cores of these teams pretty much were constructed via the Paul George trades for both of them. On the Indiana side, they traded George to the Thunder for Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis. Sabonis ends up turning into Haliburton. Oladipo turns into LeVert, who turns into the picks that end up being Andrew Nembhard and Ben Shepherd. And then on the Thunder side of things, Paul George goes to the Clippers for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and a haul of picks, one of which becomes Jalen Williams. So it's just funny looking back, poor Paul George, watching his two of his former teams go at it in the NBA Finals. And the whole reason that they are here is because of him. But now I'm going to dive into the series a little bit. And I did this same sort of format last year for the finals. I picked six swing factors for the finals. So six different things that, depending on which team kind of wins this battle or this particular thing swings in their favor, will be very determinant to who will win this series, in my opinion. So starting off with the very first one, and it's probably the most obvious one, the one that's been talked about the most, and it is Indiana's ability to not turn the ball over in this series and really just the transition battle as a whole. It is well documented. I talked about this on my last episode as well, that the Thunder have had a truly historically dominant turnover differential this season. They, on the season, forced 17 turnovers a game and only turned it over themselves 11.7 times. That was number one in terms of turnovers forced and number one in terms of not turning the ball over themselves. So they're basically sitting there with 5 to 6 extra possessions per game, which is a huge advantage, gives you a ton of breathing room for shooting variants and other things that may not go your way in a certain particular game. And in the playoffs, it's been even more of a factor. In the playoffs, they're forcing 18 turnovers a game and only turning it over 11.8 times again. So again, that's 6 to 7 extra possessions a game, and they have use that to really vault them to where they are right now. And again, that math game that they are winning on a regular basis has been so difficult for other teams to overcome, just because you can shoot better than them. You can out rebound them. You can have more assists, shoot better from the field, make more threes, all of these things like we saw from Minnesota in game four, and still lose the game just because Oklahoma City had 11 more field goal attempts in that game. And that was the single difference in the game right there. But what makes this battle so interesting is the fact that the Pacers just don't really turn the ball over very much. They averaged only 13 turnovers a game. That was third best in the NBA during the regular season. In the playoffs, that number is down to 12.7, which is impressive because usually there's a little bit more defense, more pressure, more physicality, which leads to more turnovers come playoff time. So the fact that they're lower than they were in the regular season says a lot. And they have Tyrese Haliburton on their team, who led the NBA in assist to turnover ratio this year. Had one of, I mean, game four against the Knicks was just his full repertoire on display in terms of how just masterful he is with the ball. 15 assists to 0 turnovers. He can just be so, so good at taking care of the ball. And that's part of why Indiana is so good offensively, because they don't waste possessions and they get good looks. And so that's why this battle is going to be so key. And so if Oklahoma City just makes easy work of Indiana in terms of turning them over, and they're turning it over 17, 18, 19 times a game like their rest of their opponents have this postseason, then this series is not going to be close. And so that's why this is really, really important for Indiana, because if they do take care of the ball and the Thunder do not get as much easy offense in transition, then I think that this is going to be a pretty competitive series, because Oklahoma City has been the number one transition scoring team in the NBA in the postseason at 142 offensive rating in transition. But conversely, in the half court, they have only had a 97 offensive rating, which ranks fifth in the playoffs, which isn't awful, but it is 7 full points below what it was in the regular season in the half court. So they have just not been as good in the half court in the postseason. They have relied heavily on their scoring in transition. And just another little nugget, the Pacers have actually been the number one transition defensive team in the postseason as well. So they've defended transition well, but part of why they defend transition so well is because they don't turn the ball over very much. So they don't have a lot of those opportunities, and they're not a team that really crashes the glass. So most of those transition opportunities are off missed baskets as opposed to turnovers, which is a huge difference in terms of the numbers you can have going the other way. The reason OKC's offensive rating is so high in transition is because most of those are off of turnovers, live ball turnovers, where it's one on nones, two on ones, three on twos. You know, they have those numbers versus it's a little easier to get back off a miss when you're not crashing the offensive glass as opposed to off of a turnover. But if Indiana can take care of the ball, then I think that they're going to have a huge advantage in transition, because Indiana is so unique that they can force transition opportunities even off of made baskets. They're the best in the NBA in terms of pushing the ball after a made basket and after misses. So we know that even if Oklahoma City does not turn the ball over, Indiana still is going to get transition buckets, because that's just what they've done all year long. That's what they've done all postseason long. And so they're going to get leakouts from Siakam or lob passes up to Obi Toppin. Like, those are probably going to be there, even though Oklahoma City is a very good transition defense team. Like, there's only so much you can do against this team over the span of a series in terms of stopping them there. And if they do, you know, cheat getting back, then they're going to be susceptible to giving up offensive rebounds and stuff like that. So it's going to be a push and pull there. So if Indiana can limit their turnovers and even just be near where their average is, then they're going to have a huge transition advantage, which is going to go a long way towards keeping the series competitive. Because Indiana has the number one half court offense in the playoffs to this point, but Oklahoma City is the number one half court defense. So I don't know if Indiana can rely on just for sure being super consistent in the half court, even though they've been so good there, because this is a different animal, Oklahoma City defensively. And the other thing is that I've mentioned this, that when you have 10 plus extra shots, the shooting variance becomes less of an issue if you're Oklahoma City. And Indiana has consistently outshot its opponents over the last two postseasons. They've shot better from the field in all 6 series over the past 2 seasons, even the one against Boston that they lost. And last year in the postseason, for the entire postseason, they shot 51% from the field, 37% from three. This year, they have shot 50% from the field, 40% from three, which those are just ridiculous numbers. That's crazy efficiency for like one or two of your players to have, let alone the entire team. And I'm sure they're not going to shoot that well against this defense. But the point is, OKC cannot bank on outshooting or outscoring Indiana in the half court. And so I think a big thing for them to be able to make this series uncompetitive or for them to win is to continue to generate those turnovers and get easy buckets. And so that's why this is going to be so big. If OKC can turn Indiana over, I think they're going to dominate the way they've been doing. And if Indiana can take care of the ball and outscore Oklahoma City in the transition game, then I think they've got a really good chance to make this a super competitive series. Okay, the second swing factor I have here is the Pacers' ability to knock down corner threes, which I know sounds like a very simple thing that could be applied to any series. Of course, if you make more shots, you're going to have a better chance to win. But the reason this is particularly interesting for these two teams is because the Oklahoma City Thunder are the number one team in terms of allowing the most corner three-pointers in the league. During the regular season, their opponents shot 12.3% of their shots from the corner. That was number one in the NBA. And in the postseason, it's been even higher at 13.5% of their shots. And that's second in the NBA. So their strategy is to have you funnel the balls to the corner. And we saw this last year against Dallas when they lost. And that's why they lost that series, because PJ Washington caught fire. And every time that ball swung to him, it felt like he was making it every single time. Derrick Jones Jr. was not going to dive from outside. Like, these guys made those shots. And that's why Oklahoma City didn't win that series. There were other reasons, obviously, as well, but that was a huge part of it. If those guys shoot 5% worse, then Oklahoma City probably wins that series. We also saw this against Denver, for example, where they just didn't have the reliable shooters. And if they have even average three-point shooters in that series, they probably win it. And so we've seen this be a swing factor for OKC in the past. But the other part of this is that the Pacers are one of the best corner three-point shooting teams. During the regular season, they shot 40% from the corner. That was seventh in the NBA. But during this postseason, they are shooting 47.5% from the corner. That is number one in this postseason. And just going down the line, in the playoffs this year, Nesmith is 47% from the corner. Nembhard, 47% from the corner. Miles Turner, 55% from the corner. Siakam, 54% from the corner. Haliburton, 44%. Mathurin, 43%. Obi Toppin, 40%. Even TJ McConnell is 1-for-2. low volume, but he's shooting 50%. Thomas Bryant, lower volume as well, but he's 6-for-9. 67%. He's been knocking him down from the corner. Jairus Walker, who's probably going to be injured to start the series, but he's also 2-for-3. So basically, their entire rotation is shooting 40%+ from the corner. The worst player that they have is Shepherd, who's shot 38%. But again, it's not like that's a shabby number. So that's the thing, is that if Oklahoma City is going to funnel the ball to the corner and Indiana is going to make them at close to 50%, then that is going to be a huge factor in this. And I think Oklahoma City is then probably going to have to adjust their defense a little bit to, you know, defend the corner a little bit. But that's going to open other things up, where Halliburton's probably going to have more of an open lane getting the basket. Siakam's going to have more space to operate at the elbow and in the mid range. And so that's the thing, is it's going to be a trade-off. And if they're going to make those shots, they're going to force them to adjust. But if they don't make those shots, then they're going to continue to guard them that way. And this defense is going to be as dominant as it has. And another thing is that Oklahoma City, so far in this postseason, their opponents, the Timberwolves, shot only 37% on the corner threes in that series. The Grizzlies shot only 33% on corner threes in that series. The Nuggets shot only 26%. On corner threes in that series. I mean, the Nuggets at 26% for a 7-game series. Imagine if they just shoot 33%, which is still not good. Imagine they just shoot that. Then they almost assuredly win that series. I don't even think that series would have got to 7 games. And so that's the thing, is there is a blueprint here on how to score on Oklahoma City, and it is to take advantage of the corner threes. And Indiana is poised to be able to throw guys out there that will make those shots. And so, again, shooting variance is always a factor in any series. So it sounds obvious, but it's particularly relevant between these two teams, because OKC makes you shoot those and Indiana shoots those super well. So that'll be a huge swing factor in this as well. Then moving to the third swing factor for the finals. And that'll be Halliburton's aggressiveness and effectiveness as a scorer, because they kind of live and die by him. I mean, we saw just in this past conference finals, he averaged 25, 13, and 6 in their wins, and averaged 14 and 7 in their losses. So that series could be easily boiled down to, did Halliburton play well? Then the Pacers probably won. But that extends to really their whole season. During the regular season, in their wins, he averaged 21 and 10 on 51% from the field, 43% from three. And in losses, he averaged 14 and 8 on 41% from the field and 31% from three. So, and this extends to the playoffs as well. In their wins, 21, 11 and 7, 16 field goal attempts. In their losses, 12 and 7, 39% from the field, 10 field goal attempts. So that's a 6-shot difference. And when he shoots 12 plus times in this playoffs, they are 9-1. And when he shoots 11 or less, they're 3-3. So his shooting, his aggressiveness, his involvement as a playmaker directly correlated with if they won or lost. And when he shoots more, when he's more aggressive, when he is getting more assists, when he is shooting more efficiently, again, it sounds obvious, your best player plays well, you're more likely to win, but it is particularly apparent with him because he is a little bit up and down offensively sometimes. For as good as he is, his highs are really high, but his lows can be kind of underwhelming at times. We have seen plenty of single-digit shot attempt games from him, and they cannot afford him to have those. I'm sure he'll have at least one at some point in the series, and they might be able to survive one, but they cannot have him doing that 2 or 3 times in this series, or else they're just not really going to have much of a chance. So it really is that simple. When he shoots and is aggressive and tries to get to the basket and is feeling it on a step back three, they're a totally different team. And this was apparent in the 2 regular season games against Oklahoma City as well, which I am very much I don't really care what your record against the other team in the regular season was, because there are a million examples of when it meant absolutely nothing. Boston went 4-0 against New York in the regular season. Then they get kind of manhandled in the second round this year. But in terms of the individual matchups and stat lines, I think it is maybe a little bit more relevant. But against OKC this year, Haliburton averaged 11 points and 6 assists. He averaged only 9 field goal attempts a game. That's not going to get it done. In game 1 against them, he only had 4 points on 2 of 6 shooting. It was the 3rd lowest field goal attempts he had all season. In the second game, he had only 3 assists, which was the 2nd lowest assist total he had the whole season. And his usage rate was only 13.5%, which was his lowest against any opponent this year. So he needs to be more aggressive. He needs to be more assertive. And he doesn't have to be game 4 Haliburton against the Knicks every single game, but he cannot be game 5 Haliburton against the Knicks in this series. He needs to at least be in that middle ground where he's shooting 15 to 20 times per game. He's getting 9 to 10 assists every game. And that's really what they're going to have happen if they want to have a chance in this series. The 4th swing factor I have for this series is Carlisle's willingness to shorten or at least adjust his rotation a little bit. The Pacers have been pretty adamant about playing minimum 9 guys, up to 11 in some of these games, depending on who has the hot hand and who looks good early. But it's been roughly a 10-man rotation for them in the postseason, which, again, I'm not anti-playing 10 guys necessarily, but there are particular lineups and particular players that I think the Pacers need to consider just not throwing out there at any point. The first one is the non-Haliburton and non-Siakam minutes. He consistently would have a couple minutes a game where neither of those guys are on the court. Over this postseason, they had 52 minutes total with neither of those two on the court at the same time. That is 3 to 4 minutes per game, which does not sound like a lot, but they're getting outscored by 37 points per 100 possessions in those minutes. So they are just getting killed in the minutes with both of them on the bench. And so Carlisle, he just needs to cut those. There should not be a second of any of these basketball games in which either Haliburton or Siakam is not on the court. And he even had some lineups where Nembhard wasn't out there either, which of course Nembhard is inconsistent, but at least he's a guy that can handle the ball consistently, get a shot for himself or for someone else, someone you trust to generate some offense. Like, to have all 3 of those guys out of the game at the same time, like, we're talking about the NBA finals. Some of these teams are playing their top guys 40 plus minutes a game. I get that's not the Pacers style. I get that's not their way. And that's not even what I'm advocating for. But I'm just saying you need to find a better way to have one of those guys on the court at all times. Because without either of them out there against this Oklahoma City defense, which isn't going to skip a beat when their bench players are in, they are just not going to be able to score. And so they need to have one of those guys in at all times. Obviously, preferably you have them both out there at the same time together as much as possible as well. But if you got to stagger them a little bit more, or for those 3 to 4 minutes, bump both of their minute totals up 2 minutes each, and then there you go, it's gone. And I think they can handle it. It's the NBA Finals, like I mentioned. Then another piece here is that their backup big man rotation is obviously really rough. Isaiah Jackson missed basically the whole season. James Wiseman then missed the majority of the season as well. So they've been stuck with Thomas Bryant. Tony Bradley, who was on a 10-day contract, was getting minutes in the last series. He actually played pretty well just because of the matchup with Mitchell Robinson. I do not think that that same sort of matchup is going to work in this series because the big men for Oklahoma City are just way more versatile across the board. They're not just sort of rim running, can't do anything with the ball guys like Mitchell Robinson is. And so I think that they have to cut those guys out of the rotation entirely. I know they're going to lose some size, but I don't think it's going to matter quite as much against Oklahoma City as it did against a team like the Knicks, where Robinson was just killing teams on the offensive glass. And then Towns is out there when Robinson's not. So a 7-footer out there at all times. And he's been persistent with playing these guys. I mean, he's played Thomas Bryant for 132 minutes in the postseason to this point. That is about 8 or 9 minutes a game. And they are a minus 5.4 when he's on the court. So again, not getting absolutely destroyed, but not winning those minutes consistently. And so to have 3 to 4 minutes with no Siakam, no Haliburton, 8 to 9 minutes with Thomas Bryant. I know there's some overlap in there. So if you just take out the overlap, that's 156 minutes with either Bryant out there or no Haliburton, no Siakam. That's 10 minutes a game where they're just going to consistently get outplayed, which is a huge chunk. That's about a quarter of the game right there that you are just basically conceding points to the other team. And so I really think they've got to consider ditching Bryant, ditching Bradley, and go with some more small ball type lineups. When Miles Turner is not in the game, they go with Siakam at the five, go with Obi Toppin at the five. When they made their big comeback against the Knicks in game one of that series, that was Obi Toppin and Siakam as sort of splitting the center minutes. Miles Turner was not in the game down the stretch of that series. So we've seen some success there. In the playoffs thus far, with no Turner, no Bryant, no Bradley in the game, so no traditional big, they're a plus three. So they have been good in those minutes and outscored teams. And so I think that that has been effective. And I think against Oklahoma City, I don't know if they're going to be able to like punish them like a team like the Knicks could, for example. So I think OKC probably wants to play a little smaller in this series. They want to be a little bit more versatile and switchable. And so if you're Indiana, use that to your advantage. Cut the backup center minutes, and you've got to find a way to not have any minutes without Haliburton or Siakam on the court in this series. Moving to the fifth swing factor of the series, and I kind of just talked about this a little bit, but this is the Thunder's big man rotation choices. You know, they added Hartenstein in the offseason. He has been great for them all year. When Chet missed a huge chunk of the season, he was just flawlessly filling in as their starting five. They've been starting the two bigs all postseason long, and it's been effective. But I think for this particular series, for this particular matchup, they might be better off going with the one big lineup versus the two bigs. And in the postseason thus far, they've been a plus 21.7 net rating with Chet on the court, with Hartenstein off the court. So they have been very good with Chet at the 5 minutes, and they've only been a plus 1.2 when they're both out there. So the minutes together, they haven't been negative, but clearly way, way worse when they've both been out there. And then just for perspective, the just Hartenstein minutes with no Chet, they're a plus 8.8. So they've been better with only one of them out there. They've been way better when just Chet is out there. And Chet's stats are just a lot better. They are so much more deadly offensively when he plays the five. If you look at Chet per 75 possessions in these playoffs, he's at 24 points a game on 66% true shooting. When Hartenstein's on the court, he's only at 15 points on 49% true shooting. So that sort of clogging up the lane, not that Hartenstein is obviously an issue for them. He's got that beautiful little touch floater and feels like he never misses it. He's their best rebounder. He's a very good interior rim protector, things along those lines. But when Chet is able to have more space and be the five and, you know, get downhill to the basket without a help defender waiting for him, he's just a better offensive player, and they're a better offensive team across the board. But I honestly think the main reason why I think this is a better series to have Chet at the five and dagger these guys rather than play them together is more on the defensive end of the court, because I don't think the matchups for them against Indiana are super straightforward like they were in other series, because you could put Hartenstein on Turner, but the Thunder haven't really played a true traditional stretch five yet in these playoffs. I mean, obviously Jokic is a stretch five, but he's a whole different kind of animal because he's basically running the whole offense. But then with Minnesota, Gobert is obviously not a threat out there. Against Memphis, Zach Edey obviously was not a threat out there. So they've kind of had the luxury of just dropping Hartenstein in the paint, guarding a big man and letting him kind of sit there in that role. But Turner obviously is going to be out on the perimeter. So if he guards him there, then he's going to pull Hartenstein out to the perimeter. He's going to be guarding out there, guarding action in the screen and roll. And then in that scenario, you probably have Chet on Siakam, which, again, I don't love that matchup either, because I think Siakam is bigger, bulkier, got more strength. He can probably bully him a little bit, similar to what Randall could have done when Chet guarded him, but they didn't even put him in that matchup. So that's why I think if they start Hartenstein, I don't think they would put Chet on Siakam. Another alternative is they could put Chet on like an E-Smith, for example, and then throw J-Dub on Siakam. But the thing with that is Neesmith is not exactly the same kind of player as like a Jaden McDaniels, which is what they had Chet guarding in the last series, because Neesmith is he cuts more. He is always moving. He's sprinting. He's coming off screens. He's in the action setting screens sometimes. Like, he's just a lot more active, moving on the offensive end more so than McDaniels, who, of course, it's not like he isn't a threat offensively, but when he just camps out in the corner often, he's not like running the pick and roll with the ball in his hands. He's not setting screens for them very much. He really is more of an attack out on closeouts kind of guy, which Neesmith can also do, but that's not all he does. And so I don't think Chet's going to get away with sort of cheating off the corner, because I don't think Neesmith's going to be in the corner all the time. So I don't love that one either. So you could also then put Hartenstein on Siakam, Chet on Turner, which I don't, the Chet on Turner matchup, I think, is totally fine. But again, Hartenstein on Siakam is not my favorite, because I think Siakam's a lot quicker, more agile, can probably drive by Hartenstein pretty easily. And again, Siakam plays a lot of game on the perimeter, so you're still kind of pulling him out of the paint. So that's why I think that this will be a series where Hartenstein gets deprioritized. And I think he's a really, really awesome player. But the fact of the matter is there is almost nobody to attack defensively on Oklahoma City if you're the Pacers trying to pick on somebody. And Hartenstein's probably the leading number one candidate to be able to do that. It's not like he is a bad defender in space or anything like that, but the Pacers have killed drop defense all playoffs when they've seen it. And so I think the best way to guard them is switching everything, and switching Hartenstein onto their guards is probably the most vulnerable situation you could put Oklahoma City in. If you, again, it's all relative. This is an insane defense, but I'm just saying, if you're going to nitpick something to attack, I think it's him. And some of the numbers bear that out a little bit. I mean, in the postseason thus far, Hartenstein's allowing 0.95 points per possession when guarding pick and roll ball handlers, which isn't awful, but the playoff average across the board for teams is 0.93. So it is slightly above average, which, again, I think you're going to live with average pick and roll defense most of the time. But when you look at this defense, they're not average at almost anything on defense. So average for them is bad. You know, they guard basically everything really, really well. So if you have anything that seems a little below average, that's what you should attack. And that's what has been the case for them in the postseason to this point. And then if you look at the two regular season matchups with the Pacers, they were a plus 13.8 against Indiana overall in the two games, but they were a minus five with Hartenstein on the court. So he clearly was a weak point. He was a guy that it just wasn't a great matchup for him across the board. And the thing is with Oklahoma City, they're so deep and so versatile that they could literally play him 0 minutes and win this series. I don't have a doubt about that. And so I'm not advocating for that, because I still think he can have a positive impact in certain spurts. But I just think that, you know, they really needed him against Denver because he had to guard the big body of Jokic. He averaged 27 minutes per game in that one. But then in the last series against Minnesota, he averaged only 19.6. And so Dagnall has shown a willingness to fluctuate his minutes depending on the matchup. And I think this is a matchup that is going to lead to him playing minutes in the teens rather than the high 20s. And again, it's not a knock on him. I just think that for this particular matchup, the Thunder are going to be at their best when they can switch everything. And I think that he's probably the most vulnerable in those switches. And so playing him more sort of a change of pace when Chet's not in the game is probably going to be a better look for them. And like I said, they've got options. They can play Chet at the five. They can play Kenrich Williams at the five in sort of a small ball look. They can play an even smaller look with Jalen Williams at the five, which they played a ton of this season. And that was super effective for them. And I think with Indiana, with Miles Turner not really being a threat inside, like those lineups, they're going to be able to get away with them. They're going to be way better offensively. And I think defensively, they're going to be able to switch everything and it might even be better for them. So the swing factor in this is Dagnall going to be willing to play Hartenstein significantly less minutes if the matchup says that that's what they should do. And I think that if he rides Hartenstein and plays in 25, 30 minutes, it's going to be an advantage for the Pacers. I think if he has him more in the 15 to 20 range, it's an advantage for the Thunder. Then the last swing factor in this series that I have is the game script for these. Are these clutch games or are they not clutch games? Because I think that if they are clutch games, then that is going to be advantage Indiana, because in this postseason, they are 7-1 in clutch games with a plus 37.4 net rating. They have just been like the greatest team of all time in some of these clutch games, especially some of these insane comebacks they've had. I mean, they stole game five against Milwaukee, down 7 with 46 seconds to go. They were down 7 against Cleveland. Game two in that series, only 47 seconds left to go. Then game one against the Knicks, they were down 14 with 2:51 to go. And they won all those games. So they have had a highway robbery in each of their series to this point. And outside of just those games, they've been very good in the clutch time minutes anyway. In the regular season, they were a plus 20.9 net rating in the clutch. That was number one in the NBA. And they have played 70 clutch time minutes over the last two postseasons combined. That is second most in the NBA behind only the Knicks, who had 7 more. So they're experienced in those moments in the playoffs. They have proven time and time again that they thrive under that chaos and uncertainty and the stress of those late game situations. I mean, they have multiple buzzer beaters by Haliburton just in this postseason alone. 2 game winners to go on top of that. Like, they know how to play in these games. And it's not like Oklahoma City has been bad. They're 5-2 in the clutch with a plus 11.7, which is still really, really good. But again, they were 16-8 in clutch time in the regular season, which sounds good, but they only had 14 losses. So 8 of their 14 losses, that's 57% of their losses, were in the clutch. So it just shows that if you want to beat them, that's the kind of game you have to win. And they were 52-6 in the regular season in non-clutch games. So I do not think Indiana is going to be able to blow this team out. And if they do, it'll be maybe one one-off game like the Wolves had. But that's probably it. And so they're probably not going to be able to win some of these 10 to 15 point margin of victory games. I think it's really going to have to be, can they execute in these close ones? And can they keep it close? Because OKC's just been that good and that dominant. And so if they can keep the game close, then that's going to be Indiana's opportunity to steal some wins in this series. Like in the non-clutch this season, I mean, OKC won 54 regular season games by double digits. They won 7 postseason games by double digits. They've won 4 games in the postseason already by 30 plus points, which is, again, the most ever by any team in NBA history. So clearly, I think it's fair to say we're going to get at least a couple OKC games where they cruise. I'm not saying they're going to win by 30, but I think we're definitely going to have some double-digit wins by OKC in this series. And so that's why the swing games are going to be so, so important. Of not only one, can Indiana keep some of these games closer to get themselves in those situations, but two, they have to win those games. You know, we see games like this all the time. Game one versus Boston just last year in the Eastern Conference Finals, where they had that game won. They were up 3, inbounding the ball with about 10 seconds to go. All they have to do is inbound it, get fouled, make free throws, the game's over. They turn the ball over, Jaylen Brown hits a 3 to send it to overtime, they lose an OT. It's like, those are the kind of games, like, you lose a game like that, they're not going to win the series. There's going to be a swing game or two in this, and if Indiana can win a couple of those, then they have a chance in this series. But if OKC wins even one or two of them, then it's going to be really, really, really tough for them to be able to pull this series out, because I just think that's going to be an uphill battle for them in general. And so winning these ones are going to be really important. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about what's on the line for these teams. What's at stake? What would an Indiana win mean for them and the state of the league? And starting with Tyrese Haliburton, if they were to win this whole thing, then I think we have to completely reevaluate his standing in the league. I think this run has already kind of vaulted him towards that top 10 for a lot of people. Whether you have him in the top 10, you at least probably have him close. But look, if he somehow wins this championship, knocks off this dominant Thunder team, then I think you certainly have him ahead of guys like Anthony Davis, Devin Booker, Donovan Mitchell. I think Jalen Brunson, you beat him head to head and then he wins the championship. Like, I think those are all of those sort of debates are just no longer debates, just given the resume. You even might even consider having him above LeBron, KD, Steph Curry. Like, I think that those are conversations that are legitimate to have if he were to win this and knock this team off. He also would have a championship by age 25, which since 1980 has only been done by four players. Magic Johnson won it at age 20 for the 1980 Lakers, but do keep in mind he had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on his team who won MVP in that season. You could then say by 1982, Magic was still only 22. They won it again, and he probably had surpassed Kareem at that point. So I think it's fair to include Magic in this despite the, you know, having Kareem on his team. Then 1981, the Celtics win it with Larry Bird, who was only 24 years old. Then 1999, the Spurs win it with Tim Duncan at age 23. Then you have Dwayne Wade, who wins it in 2006 for the Heat at age 24. So that's it. That's the list since 1980. Those four dudes are the only ones who have been like the guy, like a all-NBA level player as the main guy on the team, to win it by age 25. And if you just look at those teams, Bird is really the only one who won it without significant help from his sidekick. I mean, 1980, Kareem was still only 32. He won MVP that season. 99 Spurs. David Robinson had previous, I mean, he had an MVP teammate, still not really exactly in his prime, but he was only 33. He was second team All-NBA that season. Then the 06 Heat. Shaq was first team All-NBA that year. I mean, you would definitely have to say that Wade was the guy. He averaged 30-plus points in the finals, and Shaq was only 13 a game. Like, Wade was the better player by the end of the season. But still, Shaq made first team All-NBA. Wade only made second. So that was a debate the whole year. So those three, they all had an MVP player, at least semi in their prime, next to them. So Larry Bird's really the only player to have won a championship as, like, the guy without any significant help by age 25, and Haliburton would be joining that list. So it is very exclusive, and you just have to take that into consideration when you're talking about him as an all-time guy and his standing in the league. And again, I'm not necessarily advocating for him as on that level of player. I'm just saying those are the type of company that he would be in with those guys. So I think that we would, again, have to sort of reevaluate, wait, how good really is this guy? Because what he accomplished at his age and the just clear impact he has on the court is so apparent that it would be kind of undeniable at that point. Then Pascal Siakam. I think that another championship for another team as such an integral piece, I think it really pushes him towards that Hall of Fame discussion. I mean, he's a multi-time All-NBA player, multi-time All-Star. He won the most improved two championships in two different cities, which, by the way, he'd be the only player ever since the merger to be the clear-cut number two guy on a championship team for two different teams, two different cores. It's actually never been done. If you just look at some of the all-time number twos, they either only did it with one teammate and one team and one core, or they did it like as a pseudo number one, number two. You know, we've got the Kareem and Magic, who the number one was, is up for debate. Kobe, Shaq, probably Shaq at the time, but then Kobe won it with different cores, but he was the number one for one of them, number two for the other. Dwayne Wade, same sort of thing, was the number one for one, number two for the other. Then KD and Steph, who you want to say the best player is kind of up for debate with those teams. So that's kind of hard to say because it's not really the same where you were the clear-cut number two for all your championships. Then you've got the list of guys who are considered all-time great number twos, but they just were only able to do it with their same number one or the same core, the same team, like the Kevin McHale with Larry Bird, the Moses Malone, Dr. J, whoever you really want to say is the number one on that kind of fits into the first category, I guess. Scottie Pippen, the prototypical Robin. I mean, people use Pippen interchangeably with number two. David Robinson was only able to win it with Tim Duncan when he was a clear-cut number two. Tony Parker, only able to win it again with Tim Duncan as his number one. Kyrie Irving, Anthony Davis, both had LeBron James as his clear-cut number one as great number twos. And then we can talk about the Pierce and Garnett combo. I think Pierce was number one option. Garnett was the better player. So whatever you want to say about that, though, still only won it with one core. There are no examples of a dude who was just the number two, the clear-cut Robin, who won a championship on one team, went to another team with a different number one, different core, and was able to do it again. It just hasn't happened. And so he would be the only guy to have done that since the merger. And so I know he's not regarded as one of the best number twos, even in the league right now, let alone all time, but he would have to start entering some of those discussions. Again, I'm not saying all time, but like, well, we got to give this guy more respect in terms of where he stands in the league as a clear cut, awesome number two option. And like I said, I think this does push him into the Hall of Fame if he were to win this championship. I mean, he might still get there depending on how his career plays out if they don't win. But if they win it, I think that it's just a no-brainer. Then Rick Carlisle, if he were to win this championship, he joins the exclusive club of coaches to win two rings with two different teams. It has only been done three times in NBA history. Phil Jackson, obviously, did it with the Bulls and the Lakers. Pat Riley with the Lakers and Heat. And then Alex Hannum did it with the Hawks and Sixers. But that was very long time ago, pre-1970, pre-merger. So questionable in terms of just like the level of competition back then. But the other two guys are considered probably the two coaching goats. I mean, Pat Riley, Phil Jackson, it doesn't get more successful and better reputations and just winners than those two guys. And so for Rick Carlisle to be basically the only other guy in the conversation with those two is obviously puts him on a level that is just unimpeachable. And only 14 coaches even have two rings at all, let alone with any sort of team. And Carlisle, to me, again, this would firmly put him in the Hall of Fame. I think he's already going to get there anyway, but this would just put him as sort of a no-brainer. The NBA released the top 15 coaches all time when they had their 75th anniversary celebration, which was Phil Jackson, Pat Riley, Popovich, Spoelstra, Chuck Daly, Larry Brown, Steve Kerr, Casey Jones, Red Auerbach, Red Holtzman, Lenny Wilkins, Jerry Sloan, Don Nelson, Jack Ramsey, and kind of hilariously, Doc Rivers. But the point is, Rick Carlisle would absolutely be in that group with a win in this finals. He clearly passes. I mean, he's already ahead of Doc Rivers, but you know, the Don Nelsons, the Jerry Sloans, the guys who never got a ring, I think you have to put him above there. And then I think he's in the discussion in the back end of that top 10, pretty like obviously to me. Again, he's already 11th all time in regular season wins. He's in the top 10 in playoff wins. Like the whole resume is there. There's really not a hole in it. I think he just needs to maybe get more seasons under his belt to build up that the longevity part of it. But again, if he wins this, then he is in a group of just elite, elite coaches all time that it's just undeniable at that point. Then I think the biggest or the last big thing that an Indiana win would do for them and for the league overall would be setting the standard for roster construction and team building, because the way they built this team is very unique. They didn't sign some big free agent. They didn't have a top five draft pick to draft their star of the future. They didn't make some big blockbuster move where they traded four first round picks for an established all NBA guy. And if you don't do any of those three things, it is normally very, very hard not only to get star players, but to build a contender. And they've done it by attacking the margins. They've drafted well. They've only had two top 10 draft picks during this sort of rebuild. They never fully bottomed out. And those picks were Jairus Walker at eighth overall in 2023 and Ben Mathurin at sixth in 2022. And that's like their eighth and ninth man. So it's not like the team is built with the core around those top 10 picks. You know, they've just done so well at drafting some of the later picks in the later rounds. They've done so well with their trades. I mean, they took Nembhard 31st overall in 2022, Shepard 26th overall in 2023, getting Haliburton for Sabonis. I already talked about that deal. That was just, in retrospect, a complete fleece. They didn't even have to give up a pick to get Haliburton, which is insane to think about in retrospect. The Brogdon trade looked kind of funny at the time, but Nesmith is already better than Brogdon ever was for Indiana, and they got a pick back in return for that one, so it looks like they totally won that trade. Bruce Brown and three first-round picks for Siakam looks like a no-brainer now. I mean, two of those first-round picks were non-top 10 picks in the 2024 draft, which is regarded as one of the worst drafts this century, so those picks were pretty negligible. So it's really just Bruce Brown, who's already a free agent and off the Raptors anyway now, and then the 2026 pick, which, with how the Pacers are trending, I don't think they're going to miss that pick. And then even like a guy like Obi Toppin, who only took two second round picks. I mean, they basically got him for free. So they've just attacked the margins. They've taken advantage of guys who needed scenery changes, teams that were looking to dump contracts. Like, they've just done everything they can to identify guys that other teams might not be looking at and guys that might be undervalued across the league, and they have valued them, and it has led to a team that's in the NBA finals. So I think that this sort of type of team building might be looked upon to replicate more across the league, and it just shows that you don't have to bottom out and tank and have these, you know, 20 win seasons three years in a row just to try to get a star. Like, there might be a star out there that isn't established yet that you could pounce on. And that's what Indiana has done. And I think more teams would maybe look to do this as well. If Indiana loses this series, you know, I don't think they have much to lose, to be honest with you. The Thunder are minus 700 betting favorites, which, if Indiana were to win this series, they would tie the 04 Pistons for the biggest upset in NBA Finals history. So I don't think anyone's expecting them to win. I don't think that there'd be any sort of letdown or disappointment if they weren't able to win this series. And they're kind of just playing with house money. I still think even if they lose, even if they get swept in four blowouts, this is a 10 out of 10 successful season. Like, this is so far and beyond anything that anybody could have expected out of this group. Even the most optimistic fans, even probably the front office, the team itself, I'm not sure they really believed in the bottom of their heart that they would end up here, even if they're going to say that publicly. And so I don't really think there's any consequences. I think the only thing that could maybe stem from them not winning is it might put a little bit more pressure on the front office, because they're obviously closer than we thought to winning the whole thing. And so maybe they'll make another move and be a little bit more aggressive. There's already been reports coming out that they actually might be willing to go into the luxury tax, which is not something that they have been willing to do in the recent history of this franchise, or really ever. I mean, they're just not a team that has historically paid the tax, but it sounds like they're willing to. So they'll probably have to dip into there if they want to re-sign Miles Turner in the offseason, for example. But then even from there, like, do they want to make moves? They've got tradable, movable contracts. They have first-round picks to move. Do they consolidate a couple of their guys and try to improve some of their top-level talent on the team? I think if they lose, that's a possibility. So that's really the only sort of outcome or consequence I see from them losing, because, again, it would be quite literally the biggest upset in NBA history, so I don't think anybody's going to lose sleep for Indiana if they don't come away with this, and there's very, very little pressure on them at all in this series. On the Thunder side of this, if they somehow win this series, then they would cement themselves as one of the greatest teams in NBA history. And I don't say that lightly, because they just have been that good. They went 68-14 in the regular season. That is the fifth best record in NBA history. They were 16 games better than the number two seed in the West. They would be 84 wins to somewhere between 18 and 21 losses, wherever they end up with how many games they would lose in the series. But if they win with 84 wins, they would be tied for the third most wins in NBA history for a full season ever. The 16 Warriors had 88, but they did not even win the ring. So I feel like you kind of got to throw them out from this talk. Then the 96 Bulls won 87. The 97 Bulls won 84. That's the list. That's the end of the list. So they would basically be immortalized with the Michael Jordan Bulls as the most wins ever in a season to win a championship. That's the kind of company they would be in. If you just look at teams to win 80 plus games and have 20 or less losses, there's only seven of them, which if they win the series in four or five games, they would maintain that company. But that's the 72 Lakers, the 86 Celtics, the 96 Bulls, 97 Bulls, 2016 Warriors, 2017 Warriors. The Thunder are in that group right now as the 17th, and they could stay there if they win it in four or five. But again, this is just the elite company they're in. I mean, they had the second best net rating in the regular season of all time. They have a top 10 playoff net rating of all time right now as well, plus 11.2 in terms of defensive rating. They had the fourth best relative defensive rating to league average of all time at 8.5 points better. They right now are 7.9 points better than the average defensive rating in this postseason, which would put them second ever in terms of relative defensive rating. They have 430-point wins in this playoff, which is the most ever. They had the best plus minus and margin of victory in a regular season of all time. They had the most double-digit wins in the regular season of all time with 54. They had the most double-digit wins across a postseason and regular season at 61 of all time. Like, every metric we can look at says that they are legit as good as probably any other team. The only debatable ones you could argue are probably the prime Michael Jordan Bulls and the Steph KD Warriors. You know, outside of those two teams, this team has a legitimate case, not only a legitimate case, but like a favorable case in terms of being better than them if they win this finals. And I think that if they do win it, especially if they win it convincingly, they are to sweep or something like that, then I think that they could arguably be in that Jordan and Steph KD Warriors group right there. I mean, we'll see. I think that in order for them to truly be accepted in with those teams, they'd probably have to win multiple rings because both of those groups did. But assuming they're able to do that, if they do win this, which I think they're in a really good spot to be able to potentially do it, then I think that they're going to go down as a comparable group to those. At least that's what all the numbers say. But for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander specifically, if they were to win this, I would assume he gets finals MVP. He's the best player by a mile. He was the MVP in the regular season. But he would cement himself as one of the greatest guard seasons ever. If you just look at guards to win MVP and a championship in the same season, it's a pretty exclusive list. Only four dudes have done it. Bob Cousy, back in 1957, didn't win finals MVP because the award did not exist back then. But then the 87 Lakers with Magic Johnson, he won MVP and finals MVP and the championship. Then you had Michael Jordan, who just ridiculously did this four times, actually. And then Steph Curry in 2015 won MVP and then won the championship. But again, he did not win finals MVP that year. So if you look at just the dudes to win MVP and finalist MVP in the same season among guards, it would just be Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So that's the company he would be in and just the type of season he had. If you look at guys to win MVP, a championship, and the scoring title all time in the same season, which is what Shai would do if he wins this, you have Kareem in 1971, MJ did it four times, and then Shaq in 2000. So only three players, and that's by any position. So another very exclusive group that he would be in. And if he can somehow, you know, win multiple rings, I think he's going to put him in conversation with one of the best guards ever. And I know it's early to say that. He's only 26 years old and he's a three-time All-Star, three-time All-NBA. It's early. You know, if his career ended in 3 years because of a bad injury, that's going to look like a silly take. But the point is he's got a lot of runway to do it. And if you just look at the top, you know, guards all time, I mean, the list of guards to win MVP in a ring in their career at any point doesn't have to be the same season. It's not a long list. Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Kobe Bryant, Steph Curry, Oscar Robinson, Bob Cousy. That's it. Six guys. So he'd be on that list as well. And if you just look at, go down the list of some of the all-time guards, like if we're talking top 30 players all time, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Kobe Bryant, Steph Curry, Jerry West, Oscar Robinson, Isaiah Thomas, Dwayne Wade. You know, that's probably where I would have the top eight guards all time or so. But there's a lot of caveats there that Shai does not have the same benefit of. You know, Magic Johnson had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar for basically the entirety of his career. Kobe Bryant had Shaq for three of his rings. Steph had KD for two of his rings. You know, Jerry West never won an MVP. He only had one ring and he won it with Wilt Chamberlain, another top 10 player all time. Oscar Robinson only had one ring and he did it with Kareem. Isaiah Thomas did not win an MVP. Dwayne Wade did not win an MVP. So a lot of those guys either wouldn't have the accolades that Shea does in terms of MVPs and championships, or they had the luxury of playing with another all-time great. Like, obviously no one's putting Jalen Williams or Chet Holmgren in that discussion. Those guys have been, you know, gotten shit on over the span of the season and been sort of the number one reason for people to doubt this team. So that's the kind of support he has. And of course, it's a great supporting cast roster. I'm not downplaying. I'm just saying it's not Kareem. You know, it's not Shaq. So it's just so impressive, the list of players that he would be on. Like I said, I think he's got a long way to go, but he has a lot of runway to build that resume. And in terms of single season, I think you really got to put him up there with any of those guys. And in terms of long-term career, if he continues the path he's on, I don't even think he needs to necessarily win another MVP, but if he gets multiple rings and continues to be an all-NBA level player into his early 30s, then it's going to be really hard to leave him out of some of those conversations. Then Jalen Williams, if they were to win the finals, nothing crazy for him, but I think all those doubts about him as the number two option are completely put to bed. I don't think you're going to be able to really argue anything about him anymore. He would be age 24 and he'd be an all-star, an all-defensive player, an all-NBA player, and a champion as the clear-cut number two option. I mean, I don't really know what else you want the guy to do by age 24, especially. And so I think I won't say he has the most to gain on the Thunder, but he has a lot to gain in terms of just general respect across the league, that people can kind of shut up about that whole narrative. Because I've said all year that I believe that he can be that number two. I didn't know if he would for sure, because we hadn't seen it yet, but I've said that I think he can, and he's proven to do it. He was spectacular against Minnesota. If he has a good finals and they win, then that narrative is just completely put to bed at this point. And then Sam Presti, I think, has a ton to gain from this as well, because he's viewed by most as the best GM in basketball. But there's obviously one thing missing from that resume, and it is a championship. And Sam Presti, he has his misses. Like, nobody bets 1,000 in his role. You know, he traded away the pick that was Alperen Şengün. The James Harden deal obviously was a huge disaster for them. Acquiring Carmelo Anthony when he was totally washed was just not good for that Thunder team with PG and Russ. He's had some draft picks that missed. I mean, Usman Jang hasn't looked great. Terrence Ferguson was out of the league after 3-4 years. Campaign has been in and out of the league. Mitch McGarry, all those are first-round picks that just did not pan out. But again, that's just to say that nobody bets 1,000, even the best of the best. But this guy has had just so many just home run moves as well. I mean, he drafted an MVP in three straight drafts in 07, 08, 09, which is just, that alone is, that's probably never going to be done by a team again. They trade a slightly past his prime Serge Ibaka for Oladipo, who ends up being good enough to get them Paul George, and then turns out to be an all-NBA level player with Indiana. They draft Sabonis, a number 11, which was a steal of a draft pick given how good he's been in his career. He had the balls to trade for Paul George, which, given that they were a small market team, no guarantee he was going to re-sign there. He played that perfectly. He traded for him. He was on the team for a few years. They were competitive, fun. It was the post-Kevin Durant era, so it just wasn't as depressing as it could have been if they just ended up bottoming out after that. And then they trade him for what are the pieces that put this now championship-level team together. So without that trade, they're not here today, obviously. Then I think one trade he made that gets severely forgotten about and underrated was the Russell Westbrook trade, which was Chris Paul, two first-round picks and two pick swaps, which in retrospect, Chris Paul is a better player at that time than Russell Westbrook. I don't know. I mean, Paul's value had taken a hit because he looked like he was starting to decline on the Rockets and Russ was still putting up big gaudy numbers, but no doubt about it. I mean, that next season, like, Russ did classic Russ things come playoff time, and Chris Paul ended up going to the finals 2 years later with the Suns as probably the best player, even though he's in his mid-30s. So that was a complete fleece. To get the better player in the trade plus all those picks was just one of his best moves, in my opinion. Then they hire Mark Daigneault, which obviously was a home run hire in retrospect. Draft Giddey at 6, which turned into Caruso on this team. They got Aaron Wiggins at 55th overall in the draft. They signed Isaiah Joe for basically nothing when he was cut by the Sixers, choosing Chet over Jabari Smith, which was not consensus in retrospect. We should not revise history like that. Jabari was the presumed number one pick in that draft until the very last minute. So that was very much a debate and up for a question if Chet would be the pick there, but that was clearly the right choice. That same draft, they get Jalen Williams at 12. They get Kasan Wallace at 10 in the next draft. And so this would, I think he's already considered one of the best GMs ever, but this would cement him as up there for like the GOAT GM, literally, because I think his moves have been that good. I mean, aside from all the moves he's made, they are so well positioned moving forward with all the draft picks. And so to win a championship with this kind of runway for how young your team is and all the draft picks moving forward, it's unprecedented. So if he does finally get that championship, I think there's a real case for him to be the best, you know, front office GM, president of basketball ops, whatever you want to call it, of all time. And then the final question for if OKC does end up winning is the dynasty questions will begin to be surfaced, which I do feel like we kind of do this often. Like last year when the Celtics won, it was like, oh, can the Celtics run off a couple in a row here? Then Tatum gets hurt this year. They implode in the second round. And look, that is absolutely not happening. The Nuggets 2 years ago, there were people literally asking that. But then their depth started to deteriorate. They end up firing their coach. Like Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. can't stay healthy. And suddenly they look like they might not even be true contenders moving forward unless they make some sort of addition. So I think we often jump a little too ahead of ourselves with some of these. But I think this is probably the most fair question that we've asked this in kind of a while, just because one, how young these dudes are. Shea's 26, J-Dub 24, Chet 23, even the more role player guys, Hartenstein's 27, Wallace 21, Dort 25, Joe 25, Wiggins 26. Like everybody is 26 or younger, basically, except for Hartenstein, who's again only 27. So everybody is either just reaching their prime or has not yet reached their prime theoretically. But aside from that, they are so set up moving forward with draft picks. They have up to 10 tradable picks in the future. They have 17 future second round picks. They don't owe any of their own picks out. They have two picks in this draft alone, 15th overall from Miami, 25 from the Clippers. They have all seven of their own picks. They have three picks coming in next year from the Clippers, Houston, and Utah, and then Philadelphia pick in either 26 or 27. They're getting a 27 pick from Denver. They have swap rights from the Clippers in 27, swap rights from Houston in 25, swap rights from Dallas in 28. Like, they have probably the biggest war chest of picks of anybody in the league, and they might win the championship. So it's that combination I don't think has ever been done in professional sports, let alone the NBA. I mean, it is really insane how well they've set themselves up. And of course, they're a small market team. They don't typically go in the tech super often. They have done it before. I think that's a slight misconception that they would never do it. They have done it. But if they start paying all these guys, if Shea gets a pay raise and then Chet and J-Dub need post-rookie contract extensions, like, they're probably going to have to let go of some of these guys, because I highly doubt they're ever going to want to be in the second apron. And so it's probably going to cost them a Lou Dort. Maybe Wallace gets traded before his second contract. Hartenstein signed a 3-year deal. Like, they might end up having to trade him during that third year or let him walk after that or something like that. But the point is, they're in the best position you could possibly be to have to let one of those guys go, because one, they can get great value for them. They're all going to get you picks back, like good, cheap, young players, whatever they kind of want to get back in those deals. Two, they have all the picks in the world to backfill them. So they could either just, you know, package some picks to trade up and draft somebody else in the top 10, or they've been so good at drafting, maybe if they even get a later pick and they can get somebody who's develops into a good enough role player to replace those guys, or they can trade them for established players. You know, so they are in such a good spot where even if they do have to trade Lou Dort, who makes $18 million for somebody who makes $8 million. You know, that's not an issue. They're in a position to be able to backfill all these guys. So I'm normally slightly hesitant to say, okay, are they going to be a dynasty? Because I feel like we say that every year when a team wins a championship for the most part. But they are as well positioned as I can remember any team if they were to win the championship that's coming off a ring. And they're not going anywhere. That's for sure. I think the bigger question is the rest of the league going to start to catch up? You know, you got the San Antonios of the world. If they were to add KD or God forbid Giannis or whoever next to Wembanyama, I think they're going to be a big threat. And Houston's well positioned. Like, there's going to be other teams in the West, Luka and the Lakers, if they can add some better pieces, more balanced roster, like they're going to be around. So it's no guaranteed thing, and they don't necessarily have to win back to back or three in a row or anything like that to could be considered a dynasty or anything like that. If they win 3 in 6 or 7 years, then I think that they'll be pretty close there. And I think that they have the runway to potentially do something like that. So we will see, but a win would go a long way towards starting those discussions. And then if they were to lose this series, unlike Indiana, it would be quite a big deal for them because they are massive favorites. Again, they're minus 700 betting favorites, which it would put them tied for 7th all-time highest favorites in terms of betting odds. The 0-1 Lakers were minus 2,000. The 18 Warriors were minus 1,075. 96 Bulls are minus 950. 99 Spurs are minus 900. 2,000 Lakers were minus 800. 0-2 Lakers are minus 750. And then the 0-4 Lakers, 86 Celtics, and this Thunder team were all tied for minus 700. So only one of those teams at those odds are better lost, and it was the 0-4 Lakers to the Pistons, which, you know, I think it was well documented that they had some locker room stuff going on with Shaq and Kobe at the time, that maybe they weren't getting along so well. They also had a very aging roster with Malone and Gary Payton that were kind of ring chasing at the time. But regardless, that's only one of those that's ever lost, and those are the same odds as the Thunder. So that this would be tied for the biggest upset loss ever in the finals. So that's why this would be a really, really big deal. And aside from the Pistons who beat that Lakers team, none of the other series even made to 7 games. So all these teams have 1 in 6 or more other than that team. So if the Thunder even got pushed to 7, it would be relatively unprecedented considering how big of a favorite they are. And I think that if they were to lose, they obviously get removed from that all-time team discussion because you kind of have to win the whole thing to be there. Like that 2016 Warriors team that went 73-9. I've already kind of mentioned them in some of these stats that I've laid out, but I don't really consider them in that group because they didn't bring it home, and that's all the ultimate goal. So if they do not win, they are not in those discussions as far as I'm concerned. And look, the doubts would continue. The narrative of they're too young and they need more experience, the J-Dub can't be the number two on a championship team, this team just can't get over the hump. And they probably would have some pressure to make a move. I don't know if it would be for a Giannis or a KD, but there probably would be pressure for them to use some of those picks to add somebody, because this was as good of a setup for them as they're probably going to have. Like I said, there's other teams that are going to get better, teams that are going to get healthier. And OKC might not be as healthy in this time of year next year, for example. You never know. So this is a golden opportunity. If they were to blow it, then I think that nobody's going to be taking them seriously moving forward. It sounds unfair for them to have this kind of season, make it all the way to the finals, and then people tell them that their season meant nothing or that they're frauds. But unfortunately, that is what people would say. That's just how it goes with the narratives across the league these days. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that. I'm just saying that's what would happen. And yeah, this would be a really, really bad loss and just not look good for them. And then finally, moment I'm sure most of you've been waiting for, my actual prediction for the series. I think what went into my thought process is a lot of the swing factors I mentioned earlier, but I ultimately do have the Thunder winning this in 5 games. I know that is the boring pick. It is the trendy pick. It is the obvious pick, if you will, but it just is what I think is going to happen. Like I just think that Indiana is going to have such a uphill battle here. You know, the Pacers have looked so good offensively, but they've kind of torn up some really flawed defenses. The Bucks were only 12th on defense in the regular season. The Knicks were only 13th in the regular season. The Cavs were 8th overall, but from January 1st on, they were only 14th on defense. And Oklahoma City is not only first, but like I said, they have a top 4 relative defensive rating all time. So they're an all-time good defense. So going from a league average defense in 2025 to one of the best ever is, it's night and day. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a rude awakening for them, especially scoring in the half court, which I know they've been the best half court scoring team in this postseason, but I just think it's going to be a different animal for them. Look, the Pacers offense, it's really good. It's really good, but it's not all time good. It's just a very good modern NBA offense, whereas Oklahoma City's defense is all time good. So it's, you have to think they have an advantage on that front in terms of being able to stop them in some capacity. And I think a lot of that starts with the fact that they have a lot of bodies to throw at Haliburton. You know, Lu Dort is going to get the initial coverage, you would think, but when he's out, Caruso can guard him. Wallace can guard him. Like, there's never going to be an easy matchup for Haliburton throughout this entire series. And all those guys have just been so good and devastating defensively throughout this entire season. I also think the Thunder are kind of uniquely positioned to take away some of the clear pacer advantages that they've had in this postseason. Like their transition scoring, like I mentioned, Oklahoma City has the second best transition defensive rating in the regular season. So they were really good in that spot, and they don't turn the ball over. So they take away some of those live ball opportunities. As I mentioned, I think the Indiana is weirdly good at, you know, turning just a normal out of bounds play into transition, but relying on just that is tough. You know, they also have been generating turnovers and pushing the pace off of misses and stuff like that. So I think OKC is in a spot to be able to at least minimize that stuff to a degree below what we've seen from them so far. As I mentioned, Indiana takes care of the ball a lot, but Oklahoma City was a historically good team of forcing turnovers. So that might not be an advantage for them, and that's been a big advantage for them so far. And then lastly, like I mentioned, they're an elite shooting team. But if OKC wins that possession battle by 6 to 7 possessions every game, then they can get outshot and still win. So there's a lot of things that the Pacers typically rely on as sort of their calling card that they know they're going to have an advantage in. And Oklahoma City is uniquely positioned to be able to counter some of those things. I also, as I mentioned, I think Hartenstein's probably the most exploitable player on the defensive end. They don't have to play him. They're versatile and deep enough where they don't really have to. And I think Dagnall will be smart enough to sort of ride Chet at the five and go with some small ball minutes. And so OKC just really doesn't have a lot of guys to attack and take advantage of. And so I think it's going to be really hard. And I think this OKC team, I've said it for a long time now, they're an all-time great team in my view. And I just think it's going to be so tough for them to win this series. I am going to give them one game out of respect for what they've done, because they've proved us wrong all playoffs. And I hope this is a competitive series. Legitimately, I hope it goes at least six. But I think Oklahoma City is so good that it's going to be really, really tough to knock them off. And Denver got really close, but that's because they had the best player in the world, and he doesn't go down without a fight. And the Pacers, it's been such a good story. They've been so fun to watch. They've been the team I've been rooting for really in the playoffs all year, just because of how fun they are and their style of play. But I'm not sure that they have the juice to take this thing all the way home against this Oklahoma City team. So I am going to go with Thunder in five. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. As I said, the finals are kicking off tomorrow night. Probably by the time you're listening to this, it will already be Thursday, so tonight. But very excited. I think these teams are both really fun to watch. And I think, even though, as I mentioned, I think Oklahoma City has a huge advantage, I still think that it's going to be a fun series because Indiana just plays a fun brand of basketball, and they have some really exciting games as we've seen through this playoff. So I'm hoping it's competitive, and I'm really interested to see how the swing factors that I mentioned play out and who has the advantage in those situations. But I'm planning on having an episode dropped after each game of the finals to break that down and see where we go from there. So with that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.